Welcome to Ever Beyond. Beyond. On Wolf Spirit Radio, Ever Beyond Radio, and Tir na Sao in Ireland. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. Please join us in the chat room at www.wolfspiritradio.com/listen. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. And yes, you are listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning. Welcome to Ever Beyond. I feel renewed. It's been a really kind of strange, weird week. It may come up in the conversation, but mainly I want to focus on my guest because of the enormous interest factor, basically. Just to cover some of the things, you know, thank you so much to everybody who's sent in donations of machine hardware. Thank you, John, from Holland. And of cash, and I'm not sure about like naming people on air who've donated. I don't know if people want to remain anonymous or not. Perhaps I ought to put a little note somewhere. You know, do you want to be thanked on air or not? But whoever has, thank you so much. It's been a real help. You know, for Colleen and I, we work on a shoestring. You know, we're ragged shoestrings at that. Because we've been doing it for so long, and we kind of used to not getting anything. When we do get it, we really do appreciate it. It's just such a joy, it was just so lovely to be able to, you know, send some money into Colleen's account today. So thank you for everybody who sent station and personal donations. You can donate to Colleen's on HaggyShackRadio.com, and you can donate to me personally on EverBeyondRadio.com, and you can donate and get into the archives on WolfSpiritRadio.com. So, having said that, and welcome to anybody who's listening on Tir na Sao, over in Ireland there. I'm broadcasting from Scotland. Our station is based in Pahrump. And I'm speaking to my guest in centre in Whitby, lad.
North Yorkshire.
People who don't understand England have to understand that there are clans who live in different what they call counties, and these clans are often contentious with each other. There's the two accents of Lancashire, which is around Lancaster, and Yorkshire, which is around York, to the untrained ear sound exactly the same, right? And it's easy to make the mistake, but they're rivals with each other. I suppose it's like calling an American a Canadian and a Canadian American. It's very much that similar sort of thing, but, you know, we're not that. but there you are, Whitby in Yorkshire, I'd like to introduce you, first of all, as an inventor. Because that's the part that I'm really, you know, that's what I love about stuff is coming up with new stuff that is better than the old stuff, that is like quantum leaper, you know, performance, and, you know, all the bugs have been ironed out, and, you know, it's just brilliant. So, particularly things that have to do with generation of energy in the home. And so, first of all, I want to introduce Wynne Keach as a contemporary inventor who is currently building and marketing his first prototypes and production models of a wind generator. Welcome to Ever Beyond Wynne. We're gonna go as deep as you want into any topic that you like, because there are always subtleties, and those subtleties where the quantum foam hits the road, as it were, those subtleties are the ones that I like to kind of tease out, because they show the edges of what we call science and into the zone of what they call him, WS and FTM, FM, weird science and freaking magic. So the cutting edge, because it's always pushed back, and you know what was magic years ago, you know, is now normal. You know, kids have them, you know, mobile phones, a black mirror. It was a magic thing in 300 years ago. Now it's a normal thing. So, welcome to Ever Beyond, Wynne Keach. Good evening.
Thank you, JP. As you've pointed out, I hark from Whitby in North Yorkshire, which for people who don't know England very well is sort of halfway up the country, sort of halfway between Scotland where you are and London in the south. And on the east coast, it's an old whaling and fishing port. And it's famous for two things, really. Goths. We have more goths than anywhere else in the world. And we have the best fish and chips in the world, which is a Yorkshire and English delicacy.
Ah, yeah. Up here, they call it fish supper.
Fish supper, indeed.
It has been known. Yeah, of course, you know this area as well. Because of aviation experience.
Yes, I used to fly around that area many years ago when I was a lot younger.
Yeah. And my listeners may remember that I used to go onto an Air Force base in order to practice with my electric rock band, and it was the same base that Wynne used to go to in various times. But you've been around, presumably.
You've flown a few flights. A few flights, yes. I've been around to poke my nose where I shouldn't. You may know my history. I actually volunteered for the conflict in the Falklands, and continued with the Air Force for a few years after that. And my first chance to actually request a detachment, I put in for Akrotiri in Cyprus, and they sent me to the north of Scotland instead.
And anybody who knows the difference between north and, actually, I've been from North Cyprus I've been from Cyprus to the north of Scotland, and I sprained my ankle the moment my foot touched the ground, because the ground was ice. I just went straight over. Oh my god!
Yeah, anyway, I prefer mountains and ice, so actually it suited me better in the end.
you prefer the cooler climb, yes.
I do. It's the Viking inheritance from being on the northeast coast of England. We have a lot of Viking blood, so we hark for the mountains and the snow.
Ah, right. Yes, land of the ice and the snow, and the midnight sun. Hey, you're in a rock band, weren't you?
I was. I was in a rock band with some quite famous musicians. I was the rather weak bassist in a band called Dive. It was in circa 1989, 1990. Cool. And although the band didn't continue, some artistic differences between the drummer and singer and the rest of the band, i.e. he did us over, as the lead singers tend to. But the lead guitarist and keyboard player from the band actually became very famous musicians and composers. They founded the music video game company Rare. And Grant, my lead guitarist, is actually voted in the top 30 all-time greatest classical composers on Classic FM. So, how times change.
From rock and roll to classical composition. Brilliant. I love that.
Yeah, we still rock, though.
I still rock, you know. Well, I used to. I don't know. I picked up my guitar the other day and tuned it. There's a good thing. Yeah. I forced my girlfriend to sit through me tuning my acoustic guitar with the 432 tuning fork. It took me about half an hour, just really, really carefully. But it was just a nice experience to tune into it and just allow that note to zoom around.
I try to confine my activities to grandfather moshing now. Yes, I'm well known for leaping around like a lunatic to any decent music, especially if it's live.
Yeah. So watch out, anybody who might have a pair of glasses that might fall off in the mosh pit.
Yeah, well, anybody that knows me, I don't need to apologise to, because they already know me.
Right. Yeah, keep out of Wynne's way.
So back to
meanwhile,
interest. Yes.
Meanwhile, we've spoken. You spoke on Simon Parkes' first show, a very popular show. Lots of people saw that.
I did. Yes. It's always good to speak with Simon, and over the years, Simon and I have become friends through this.
So, did you meet through the company?
No. We met through the subject. Simon actually, it's a long story, but
By the way, how'd you meet him?
Okay. Well, it works like this. As you may know, most people seem to know me for my crop circle research work, which is only a small fraction of things that I've actually done in my life, but nonetheless, I was probably more successful than most at filming crop circles, and the 7-7 formation was one that unfortunately launched me into the public eye, which I didn't really want, but nonetheless, it was a very significant event. We recorded it as best we could, and you know, I went on record to defend it because it was very important information that we managed to capture that night. Subsequent years, the environment down there changed, and in 2008, the following year, there was what can only be described as some dark influences came into the fields, and they were transdimensional, and I managed to film these entities coming in and out of the field, and in fact opening a portal to do this, which caused some feathers to be ruffled in the crop circle community down there. Because there is, as you probably gathered, alongside the actual phenomena, that there is an industry growing up against it, and that industry likes to portray everything connected to it as being owned and controlled by them in some respect, i.e. it is our phenomena, which the phenomena doesn't agree with. And everything is all love and light. There is no balance. It's all simply completely positive. And that isn't actually the case. The situation is actually very much more complex than that. And yes, there is a very positive and very evolutionary process connected with some of the crop circles. Then there are people that are hoax them. There are people who are sent there to hoax them. So there is a whole spectrum of things that happen down there. But nonetheless, the fact that these entities have turned up, I filmed them, which I film everything, you know, if it moves, if I'm down there, if it moves, I film it. And not only were the entities very upset that I managed to film them, which came back to me for a number of weeks afterwards, quite high on the level of harassment, you could say, but I don't respond well to harassment, so that didn't go very far. But also, I was asked at that time to headline a talk in Marlborough about crop circles for one of the local crop circle organisations. And I duly went down, and I was set up on stage to give my talk about 777 and show all the relevant footage, etc., etc. And just before I was allowed to speak, I was literally thrown off stage and thrown out of the building, which upset 200 or so people in the audience. And puzzled me. And it turned out the organisers thought that I might be talking about these entities I'd filmed, which I wasn't going to. But nonetheless, they were so afraid that I might that they threw me off stage, and somebody else actually gave my talk, which was a bit off, really. And that was that. I had a word with the organiser and said, you know, what are you playing at? And they said that they thought that if there was anything that could be perceived as being negative, it might affect their business, which I don't have much sympathy for. So I left it at that and said, well, never ask me to speak down here again. And duly went back up to Whitby, and a local ufologist who was aware of this incident decided to put on a local conference, really, so that things like this could be actually presented to the public without interference, which is very good of them. So this was in Filey, which is, if anybody knows this area, that on the coast we have sort of three large tourist spots, or three spots that are very tourist magnets. One is Whitby, which is that's an old whaling port and is highly regarded. And we have Scarborough, which is a much larger town, which is maybe 12 miles south of here. And that's a very popular tourist destination, a seaside destination. And then a similar distance below Scarborough is Filey. And those are the three tourist hotspots on the coast here. So we gave the talk in Filey, and Julie went through all the various things and showed all the footage and one thing and another. And at the end of the talk, as often happens, people come up and ask questions, or you know, want things clarified, or etc. etc. And one of these was Simon, who I didn't know at the time. And Simon had come up and he'd seen what I'd been talking about, and he said, "Look, you obviously know a lot about these things. You're talking about things here that you know, you can't find the information anywhere else. Nobody could make it up. You know, this is obviously for real." And he explained that he was in a quandary, in that he'd had these lifelong experiences. He wanted to come to the public with it. His position as councillor, MP, were coming forward like this could be detrimental to that, and he was quite concerned about that. But he felt that it was so important that he should come forwards, and he wanted my take on it. And this is how I got to know Simon. And shortly after that, Simon went public with it, and you know, the rest is history. Because obviously Simon has had extraordinary experiences all his life. And in some respects, I think it had been something of a burden, because it's almost like living two lives for him. And through this, I got to know Simon, and the more I knew him, the more I liked Simon, and we've become great mates as a result.
So this is the whole thing about when you discover that all the things that you've been holding inside, and you're standing next to another human that you've never spoken to these things about, and you start talking about it, and you realize that actually this person really understands what I'm talking about. And
yeah, exactly.
All these years I haven't been saying anything because I felt that nobody would understand me, and perhaps that was true.
And well, exactly.
You know, you have to wait until you get to the right person who you just know, the you get that sense of trust and things like that.
Yes, well, think of it from Simon's perspective. I mean, the things I brought forward, I'm very scientific, as you probably know, and I'm, you know, classically trained scientist, engineer, innovator, and I methodically measure, record everything. So everything I come forward with, I have hours of footage, photographs, measurements that back everything up.
Rigorous.
Absolutely rigorous, and that was my objective, was to be the most rigorous primary acquirer that I could be, to find really what was the detail, the depth of these phenomena. And Simon it has to come up there without that. You know, he's not had his life followed round by a film crew. so he can't stand up there and go, you know, there's my mum, there's my dad. You know, he can't do that. So even more difficult for him, and it was difficult enough for me, so I can sympathise entirely. I just wanted to present the data set to any researchers that would find it useful, and anybody out there that would find it useful, and not necessarily for me to be associated with it, because I didn't see what I added to it. You know, my credibility should not be a factor in the credibility of the data set. So I was coming at it from a different end. But in the same token, I've had experiences across my life which you know, are in some respects similar to Simon's, in that they are as far removed from normal reality as you could possibly expect to be. But nonetheless, they're observable, repeatable, and therefore I consider it scientific.
And you're referring to crop circle evidence, but more than that, yeah?
Oh, much more than that.
Contact?
Oh, yes. Contact, crop circles.
Rides in ships?
I've not had any rides in ships in this life.
Mm-hmm. What do they call that? Is that CE6 or 7? It's like, when can I drive?
I've no idea. I think in my life that would probably be taking without consent if I got in one of them.
Being followed by the space cops.
Yeah, you'd know if I'd been in one, because I'd be parking it outside your house right now.
Pick me up. I'm off. I'm in for it. Yeah. Go for a quick. It's the. I had. Do you know who Alex Collier is?
I know Alex. I've read his first release many years ago, Defending Sacred Ground, and I was blown away by it.
So I was talking with him about how he was taken on a ship. He was, you know, they took him up on a ship, and how they he was telling us how when they let him sit in the driver's seat, as it were, and Moroney took his hand off Alex's shoulder just to give him full control. And of course, the more he realized that he was in control of the ship that had no feedback mechanism, you just had to have a still mind.
Yep.
And his mind was all over the place, because he obviously had no practice on that. And of course, the ship started to wobble around, and everyone was, and eventually Moroney put his hand on his shoulder, and everything calmed down again. I wonder if Alex would like to take another, because it must be something completely other to what we're when you drive a car, okay, we're used to gears and linkages and resistance and clutch pressure and hydraulics and all of those things. But I suppose, like in a modern airplane, do you still get, even with the fly-by-wire, is there resistance to these things? The kind of feedback that you get, I'm talking about.
Feedback's programmed into it, but I've flown aircraft from everything that's made out of wood and stretched canvas to things that are fly-by-wire. So each aircraft has its own different characteristic, but they all fly according to the same physics and in roughly the same manner. But you do get accustomed to ways of operating. Before I volunteered to fly, I'd never even sat in the cockpit of a plane. Something instinctively told me that when this conflict sprung up, basically in the Falklands on the neighbourhood of the Antarctica, that I knew this was significant. I was in the sixth form at the time at school, which I don't know how Americans would call that.
Well, how old were you?
I was 18.
18, so you're 18 years old, so just about ripe for the Army and for the RAF, Royal Air Force.
I was previously, slated to be either a surgeon or an engineer, and, I'd done Latin and Greek, the whole works, and went to a very successful school, so to just up sticks and join the Air Force was a bit of a drastic move, but I felt so compelled to do it. And I didn't know why that particular conflict had drawn me, but it's obviously the region. Something within me knew that this was a real threat, and that I had to do the best thing I could to prevent this threat. And my analysis of it was that I could do the best from inside an aircraft. And the fact that I'd never actually sat in one before doesn't seem to be really much of a hurdle to me, which may seem odd, but that's how it went. And I duly volunteered. I was also put forward for a scholarship, which I gained. That's basically 25 people out of 2,500 air cadets that apply, which is hotly contested for. I'd never actually sat in a plane. I went through the whole process, through all the aptitudes, everything, without actually knowing how a plane worked. And first time I sat in one was when I was doing basic flight training. And that's the same moment as Alex there, 3.5 hours after I sat in a plane, I'm lining up to take off, and the instructor says, "I'm getting out, you can fly it now." So I know that moment that Alex has had for doing something which is probably a little bit more simple to fly.
Yeah, probably in that way, but so you were kind of thrown in the deep end, but they probably knew that you wouldn't sink.
Oh, absolutely. They're very careful about these sorts of things.
Yeah, they wouldn't entrust like a $1 million craft to somebody who they didn't recognise had a certain talent. Would they have also been told that you had a certain talent?
I've no idea. Yeah. I've no idea.
Is there anything like that involved in your life, that there's what do we call those programs involved? If you see what I mean, projects, government projects, like or corporate projects. Okay, well, yeah, just keep going. Just keep going.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes, so I can understand Alex's position there. And certainly it was interesting. I'd actually developed my interest in UFOs before I'd volunteered for the Air Force. You still there?
Yep.
Very quiet. Yeah, you went very quiet.
I mute myself so that I don't get feedback.
Yeah. Simply because of where I live. I live up here on the moors, near Whitby, and I'm next to a big radar base, which is a space tracking radar. It's one of the most powerful radar sets on the planet. And it seemed to attract an awful lot of attention. And in the mid-1970s, when I was actually helping to build the house that I live in, the number of craft that were coming up past our house to go over to the base was huge. You know, there were several a week, and they were leisurely just flying past my house while I'm still working on it. So we're working all hours, day and night, on the thing. And yeah, it's got to the point where I used to take my father's Land Rover without his knowledge and chase them across the moors, and I got quite good at it. And when I had the chance to potentially fly, you know, especially fly something that was pretty nippy and had weapons on it, then I thought, great, I'll be able to hunt these things down even better. But to be fair, I think I got closer in the Land Rover.
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? just like getting like 1/10 of the speed or less.
It's obviously perceived as less of a threat.
Yes, and you know, they're probably just like, oh, what's that little tin box thing?
Yeah. Yes, strange self-propelled
spam
chariot.
Spam in a can.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Yeah. So that generated my interest in this. Initially, at this time, you have to understand, I'm a different person to the person I am now. I was very left brain, very methodical, very logical, and I didn't think these were otherworldly craft. I thought they were some sort of advanced Russian device. They were flying in off the North Sea. I could see them coming in from miles away, and they were obviously interested in the base. So that would be your logical conclusion. So, imagine my surprise when it turned out that nobody had things that performed the way they did. Nobody on Earth had them.
That we knew about. Wynn, can you hear a kind of clicking tapping sound on the call?
I can't hear a clicking tapping. I can hear a low hum. That's all I can hear.
All right. Well, the low hum's from my thing, but I don't know if there's a very it almost sounds like someone's typing, but I'm sure it's not. I'm just not getting parallel. It's probably like a cable hitting the side of a.
Okay. I'll stretch the cable away. See if that's part of it. Okay. Is that any better?
Well, we'll see when you start speaking. It just sounded like there was someone clicking away in the background, and it's like, oh, is that someone typing? No, I'm just being paranoid. I'm just being paranoid. That's good. It's good when you know that you're just being paranoid, and you're not being...
Okay, there's silence at my end, so
that's good. That's good. So, Wynn, let's just go... You experience all kinds of conventional aircraft. Have you ever experienced any, and this is what I was saying about government programs or non-government programs, as I say, what's known as exotic aircraft, i.e. ones that have got like Searle engines or Glock engines or anything like that?
Yes, I have. I've worked on them. One of the things I did after the Air Force was I was an engine designer at Rolls-Royce for 7 years. And yes, I worked on conventional aircraft, commercial jetliners, fighter jets, that sort of thing. But I was also working there at the period where we had a thing called HOTL, which people should go away and look up. And this was a Mach 15 replacement for Concorde. And we had that thing flying... Mach 15.
That's almost as fast as the lunar module.
Yep. Oh. Yeah, it's as fast as ISIS.
What was it running on?
It was...
what did you stick in the tank at that? or is it?
Yeah, it was a hybrid engine. It ran. It wasn't actually one engine as such. It ran as a conventional air scavenging high bypass gas turbine engine on one level, but it also then became a liquid hydrogen oxygen burning hybrid scramjet when it got above Mach 3. And various aspects of that engine are still classified, and I was on the design team there.
I just imagine like being able to fly this thing, and it would be like riding a 250cc motorbike to riding a screaming Kawasaki that had been bored out and tweaked. You know, it would be terrifying. Absolutely terrifying to drive this thing.
Well,
you've no idea. I mean, what kind of G is this thing? You would black out if you.
Not necessarily.
Does it have a gravity generator?
No, it had nothing like that.
No inertial damping.
It was quite conventional in terms of the engineering. It just was rather exotic in what it did, in that it would climb. The profile was, for instance, for it to take off from Heathrow, climb to the edge of space, where it would cruise at Mach 15, then glide to a landing in Sydney, Australia. And that flight profile was scheduled to take just over 45 minutes.
Holy Lord!
And wow. We had the prototype flying in the mid-1980s. So I can't understand what what Mr. Branson's messing around with bits of plastic flying around in the desert for. We had better things than that 30 years ago. So, that aircraft must be due for, whatever happens, that is a good question. Mrs. Thatcher closed that program down very quickly after we had it first ready to go. And we've never seen of again. But I can imagine it's gone somewhere.
Do you know what my fantasy, when you're talking about this, that I was thinking, who would have that now? It would be a Bond villain. Wouldn't it? Mr. Bond. Yes, you remember these aircraft here.
We have been expecting you.
We have the whole fleet here. Underground base in Norway. Oops, sorry. Anyway, meanwhile...
I would imagine that it would have made a superb reconnaissance craft.
Oh, totally.
The SR-71 Blackbird is, retired now. And if you were going to have a replacement, that would be a direct replacement for it.
Yes, did a couple of go-to pros on that. You'll be fine.
But also, as a rapid weapons delivery system, it would have been exceptional. There were, it had the ability to carry 3 tons of anything. So I can imagine that it could have gone to many places, but we never saw it again. We just made it, and off it went.
Would
but
it
the technology
actually
was there.
Survive
the mid-80s? Yeah.
Would it have
this
actually survived?
This is the mid-80s. Most sophisticated thing on the road of Britain would be a Ford Capri, and we have a Mach 15 aircraft. Never to be seen again.
Would it have been able to survive a space journey?
It was designed to fly as a space vehicle. Yes, I don't know. I don't know if it would have the range to travel beyond the planet, but it was certainly capable of putting satellites into orbit.
Wow! I was just saying, it's probably on Aldebaran by now. But
it's probably resting in a desert somewhere in the sort of Midwest or something.
The old ones it was exactly that wire that was making the thing. So you weren't being, nobody's being bugged. Everything's fine. We're just fine. We're talking about old technologies. Nobody's going to get hurt.
There's old technologies, new technologies. This is 30 years old, so that's an obsolete piece of technology now. So what must have been created by people who've replaced me in those environments since must be astonishing.
Absolutely.
And it must be difficult to tell now the difference between what we make and what others are making.
Well, I mean, really, there are all the components are going to be made by the same companies, aren't they?
Oh, I would think so, yes.
This is Cliff High's idea, is that in some company, they're making components for spaceships and things like that, for the secret space program. And somewhere, there are components that they're making for all their devices, their healing devices, their replicator devices, and somebody is making these components that just need to be slotted together in the right way to create a domestic replicator. Wouldn't that be cool?
It could be anything being manufactured. You wouldn't know. If you're a manufacturing company, you could be manufacturing components to a design and a tolerance, and it could be anything.
Exactly, you'd just have the widget,
You'd have no visibility of what it fits to or what it's supposed to be doing, so long as it meets the specification.
Exactly, yeah, I mean, you can just say, oh, novelty, you know. Lights, three lights, oh, yeah.
So certainly, you know, there is this sort of, there seems to be this two-speed approach to both science and engineering as to what we see in the daily life and what has already gone before. I mean, okay, I'm looking back 30 years into you know, my history, but I look back as an innovator and as a basically a scientist back to what happened 100 years ago, the things that were being done 100 years ago that we're still not doing now or that we've lost the thread for. Understandings, for instance, of ether physics. You know, as soon as Einstein came along, that went out the window. So many things that have actually been done and just overlooked. It's astonishing.
And they're all in the patent office, and a lot of them have been held back. Have you had trouble with the patent office?
I've not had trouble with the patent office, no. I've always been successful in getting patents. But I've had certainly a lot of resistance from existing corporate environments, in that things you wouldn't consider to be such a terrible threat to people suddenly seem to be. I mean, my wind turbine, for instance. You would think that that would be the least threatening piece of technology you could imagine. But you know, just by my inventing one that you can barely see, it makes no noise, it doesn't damage birds, bats, or even insects, it's fit and forget for 20 years, it's actually a third of the cost of a comparable sized unit so that anybody can afford it. You would have thought that that is not a threatening thing, you know? The wind blows, it makes energy. The wind doesn't blow, it doesn't. And you sit there and it, you know, makes a proportion of the energy you need for your house or your business. But the enormous resistance we've had to getting that to the market has been astonishing. I've never experienced anything like it. And that's just a windmill, basically.
Well, perhaps you need to take a different approach than the regular marketing approach. Maybe we should throw some ideas around about how you can make it work without, you know, just make it happen without having to be subject to that kind of stuff.
I think in the 6 years I've been working on the wind turbine, the world has changed in front of my eyes, and I think that's now possible to do that sort of thing. In that, before, to take a product to market, you'd have to go directly through either a distribution line or through existing corporations to get it into the marketplace. But now I think so many people have actually woken up and are now becoming sensitive to both the environment and their own awakening, that I think there are enough people out there now that could be connected via things like the internet and social media to actually bypass the entire normal route to market for things and to do it directly with people.
Well, the other thing is these the idea of a 3D printing station that had all different materials that you could, do you think your device could be 3D printed, you know, and the bearings pushed into the things and with the hub puller, and then away they go?
You could do, but it would cost a lot more. Big part of the development work for my wind turbine was cost engineering, in that maximum performance, maximum reliability, maximum quality, but at minimum cost. Mm. So we use manufacturing techniques that are less expensive than comparable devices. So, for instance, we extrude the blades rather than machine them. We don't have to cast, you know, blades and balance them. You know, they spit them out of a machine. They split kilometres of it out at a go.
Really? Lovely.
So the quality is very high, but the actual manufacturing cost is lower, and the complexity is optimized to be as minimal. So there's as little to go wrong as possible. And
are they a self-assembly thing?
They can be self-assembled, yes. They're designed to either be assembled as single modular units, or you buy them in pre-assembled blocks of five that are a complete unit you just literally drop on your roof.
And how long... Oh, the, is the unit... You see, I've got a picture of you standing with a thing. A column, looks like a cray wire.
Oh, that'll be a rotor out of one of the turbines, yeah.
Yeah, so... it's essentially a couple of those inside a casing.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. You have one of those. One of those is each in each unit. So you have a rotor and a casing in each unit, mm-hmm. and generally five units connect together with an alternator unit. And there you go. You just plug them together, and away they go, making electricity.
Could you run on one?
You could run on one if you had a lower energy demand, but most they're designed to make use of the roof of a building. So we can make the turbine 8 times smaller than it would otherwise be as a propeller by using the roof to accelerate the airflow into the unit. So when you put it on the roof, it becomes basically part of the roof airflow system. Mm. So the roof is amplifying the wind speed into the unit, which means we can reduce the material cost, the visible size of it, etc., etc. So, yeah, that was the basic premise of it, but it's comparatively simple compared to other things that I do. And you would think that, you know, you'd think it was shock and awe and consternation for the world of energy that somebody made a wind turbine that works.
Well, this is the thing. No, that's they want them not to work. They want them to be rubbish. Because the Rothschilds want them to be rubbish because they got nuclear power, and the Rockefellers want them to be rubbish because they've got oil. And it's just, if you messes, and as Sean says, you know, if you messes with the dough, you got to go. So if anything is bad for business, it gets leaned on. But
I've seen quite terrible examples of this. I'm the chairman of a very large engineering company that installs the enormous wind turbines, the reporter said, are these things effective? He says, I don't know and I don't care, they make me a lot of money. And that was his entire take on it. And I've also spoken to environmentalists who say, yeah, these big ones, the corporations like to put them up because they are very visible. The very thing that makes people hate them, apart from the decapitating thousands of birds a year and making an enormous racket of noise.
Yes, the ultrasound.
The infrasound as well, yes.
I meant the infrasound, but yes, the very low frequency sound that you can't hear because it's low enough, but people experience it in their gut and everything like that.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. They want them to be noticed, so yes. they're saying it's a totem. It is something that, you know, we are seen to be doing something because we put this enormous great blot on the landscape in front of you. So there it is. Rejoice.
Look, you wanted renewable, though. There you go.
Yeah.
Except it doesn't work. I just want to say, Wynne, you've solved many of the problems that people have with turbine. Number one, the bracket. Number two, the slicing of the birdies and the butterflies and the bees and anything else that's, you know, that is riding around on the like bugs on the windscreen. The inability of this device to turn when it's really a low wind, and the ability to take a high wind. It's got a small tolerance. Mm-hmm. People have a lot of wind turbines here up in Scotland, as you know. But I have wind all the time of year. I have more wind than solar. So if I had some way of very cheaply harvesting wind, I've even got a shed that is in the kind of wind corridor. It'd be a perfect place to mount one of these things. I can see it there. I'm just visualizing it, like, sitting on top of my thing, generating a goodly amount of current. What would you get? I mean, for five turbines, what's the kind of kilowatt energy you're getting out?
And then in the area you're in, mm-hmm. Around 3,300 kilowatt hours a year.
3,000.
Just about enough to run a small house where you are.
Yeah.
Where I am, about 2,400 kilowatt hours a year. Mm-hmm. The south of England, maybe about 1,800.
And do these go into batteries?
They can. I initially developed them to go into battery storage. because that's the most effective way of using it. The things with renewables are they're intermittent.
Yes, right.
Whether it's solar or
especially
wind.
Especially with wind, yeah.
It's feast or famine. So to be able to smooth out that with storage is the logical answer. But unfortunately, you then have the commercial interests take over, and everybody wants them to make money, so they want to grid tie them and just squirt whatever it makes into the mains whenever the wind's there. So I designed it for one thing, but the commercial market is entirely another. Are you still there?
Yeah, yeah. So what's your... Do you install whole systems, or just like a supplemental to the thing? And what plug do you use? What kind of cable is coming off the generator?
Okay, Ridgeblade is designed to be complementary to solar. So if you can just imagine something that electrically looks like a wind, looks like a solar panel that is generated by wind rather than sun. That's what you have. Working on the principle that wherever you are in the Northern Hemisphere, you either have a day that's windy or you have a day that's sunny. So if you put wind and solar together in an affordable package, you have good availability of renewables, which means you can reduce the amount of storage you require, which reduces the overall cost. So it's like having your car is an integrated system these days. You don't just have an engine and a gearbox and a steering wheel. Everything is integrated, so it's maximized for its own interdependence and maximum cost efficiency. It's the same with Ridgeblade. Ridgeblade and solar together are designed to work together, so that you can take, if you just had a wind turbine, you'd probably get 20-25% availability of power during the year. You put it with solar panels and Ridgeblade together, you'll get over 70% availability, which is as close as you're going to get without storage to being able to have a continuous supply of energy to run your house, your business, your remote site, whatever it is.
All right. Well, my needs are modest here in my little cottage because I live alone. So I just need my water heated, but that's heated. I need the fridge and freezer.
I have a product for that. Actually, my second product.
You have a product for that? We have an app.
I have that. Yes. Well, yes, there's several other products about to come out of my stable, as it were.
I knew there was something new. I knew I needed to talk to you. Winkle picked this out of you. Come on, then, Win. Spit it out. Let's see what's coming out of the laboratory.
I have a low-cost, mass-manufacturable heat exchange system, which is called Heat Grabber, which works with solar and works with Ridgeblade, and that, with a typical 2 or 3 kilowatt solar installation, will provide hot water all year for a typical house, and it'll provide background heating for a typical house for all but 2 months of the year, and in those 2 months it'll still produce around 50% of the background heating.
Wow. And how does it work? What does it run off?
Well, as I'm patenting at the moment, I can't tell you too much, but all I can tell you is that it increases the efficiency of the solar system the solar PV system that goes with it, and it's a self-powered heat exchange system. It has some interesting twists. The important thing is that it's designed again to be very cost-effective. So it isn't designed for maximum efficiency; it's designed for maximum cost efficiency.
I see. Are you drawing the infrared energy off the back of the PVs?
That's part of it. People already do that, but it does some other clever things as well. But if you can think of it as just a system for removing environmental heat in an efficient manner that doesn't require any external energy, that's what you have.
That's very useful. That's like an elephant's ear, isn't it?
Well, basically, my house, I live off-grid, okay, and have done for 4 years now. Largely because I have access to wind turbines and things, but I've lived it. So you know, I've experimented with my house is really more of an experimental off-grid living centre than a house. So for instance, my house has 4 electrical circuits rather than 1. It also has low voltage LED lighting circuits. It has solar systems, wind systems. It has its own sewerage, its own water supply, everything. So I've been completely off-grid for 4 years. And so I've lived through every stage of technology. And when you do that, you know, when you go, when you first go in there and you throw the switch on the fuse box and you're now running off everything that you're generating, you very quickly start to find in the day-to-day life what you need and what has the highest priority. And the first thing is you want light. The next thing is you want your fridge to run. After that, you want your computer and TV to run. And straight after that, you want a tank of hot water a day. And you just go down the list. And so the technologies I've been developing are simple technologies that are affordable, mass manufacturable, so with a view to being able to take any house anywhere in the world and make it off-grid. And that's what I've been doing for 6 years. And I'm at the point now I can do that.
Super, because strangely enough, Wynn, this is one of the things that I've been wanting to do. You know, so you say, all right, so you got six circuits. All right, you're the genius, you're the... I bow. But my girlfriend and my friends can vouch for the fact that I've got a DC... Well, I've got a DC circuit of 12 and 5 running, yep. Plus an audio circuit so that I can listen to the show in the kitchen and in my bathroom. So, you know... I'm playing with Arduinos and remote controllers and things like that, radios for 433 megahertz and the remote controllers you get from Radio Shack and things. Anyway, so that's all great fun.
But it has real world applications and a lot of it comes out of it. I mean, things I've done along the way. I mean, I do a lot of innovating for general any good cause. So, for instance, I was approached by a chap who had been approached by a government near India, and they had a requirement where they wanted to give away 120,000 lighting systems so that children weren't going to burn themselves to death or pollute their lungs with burning paraffin all the time, so they could do the homework and that sort of thing. To small houses, which are really small shacks, you know, like small sheds that they lived in, that they'd never had lighting before, but they wanted a system at low cost that would light a small building. It had to be self-contained. It had to be able to be simply operated by somebody who'd never experienced a battery system or a light system or anything before, to be powered by solar. And they had a cost that it needed to be done for before they could afford to do it. And so I worked with a colleague of mine, and we set up a project, and we called it Light from Light. And I designed the storage and electronic sort of microsystem, and we used what was then the most cost-effective and efficient LED lighting systems. We designed it all to be pre-wired. You just plug it together with a little solar panel. And the cheapest price they could get such a thing made for was around €200. We got a high performance system ready for delivery to that area for €56 a system. And that was that's what we did. And so we did that completely, you know, free and gratis. It was just work to support this charitable project. So that's an example of a spin-off from the work that I do. I've worked on, for instance, ways of making liquid fertilisers more efficient so that you could grow nearly two crops a year instead of one crop a year for the same amount of fertiliser. All sorts of things. The whole range of sort of eco-technology I've worked across, and I found solutions to all of them. And really the only question and hurdle I see in the world now is, do people really want the solutions? I spent 6 years of my life finding the solutions, and it's now a case of who really is there out there that isn't just talking about it but wants a solution, and are there enough people on the planet to make it worthwhile for humanity to move forward in a good direction?
Of course. Well, what you're looking for is what's known as the 6%, the first takers, the people who can see that what you've got is a really good thing. Mm-hmm. And they're the people who also have the ability to finance that kind of thing. They're the geeky, maybe rich kids, and things like that. So there are different. But really, have you considered speaking with science magazines and things like that?
No, because I'm really kind of an alternative scientist, I've kind of parted ways from mainstream science.
So you're not really close to popular mechanics. Unpopular mechanics.
Unpopular mechanics. I do the tricky thing. I do the thing which so few people can do. I can innovate on demand. And it may sound like a simple thing until you try to do it. And I thought it was a simple thing until I tried to do it in the beginning. The first thing I invented, this would be getting on for 30 years ago now, would be the solid-state thread tensioner for spinning looms. And closely followed by the low-cost UV dosiometer, which is a fadeometer which costs pennies that you could wear as a wristband and see if you're being exposed to too much sunlight. Those are the first two things I ever invented. But to do that and go through the patenting process and to have that thought that nobody else has had, you have to have an original thought to do it, is far more difficult than anybody would ever imagine.
Because everything's already been thought of.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how much thought people have given over the last, hundreds of years to something. So to find something that's novel and inventive and have an original thought actually is very difficult.
Yeah.
And it also means that you have to push yourself spiritually to a point where you are on the very edge of human spiritual consciousness. As you are looking over the edge, you're looking for the next thing. You're looking not for something that the group consciousness has experienced and internalized. You're looking for something that is a potential that's never been explored.
Amazing. This is and this is the kind of cutting edge of science that I'm looking for on my radio shows. That I'm looking towards. I try to do all the time is what I call black ops science, or the science that they use in these black ops things where they have levitating craft and things like that. But there are U.S. soldiers in it. They work because of a scientific tweaks that they know that we don't. If we can just allow those concepts to come out, then nobody gets killed by revealing any secrets, do they?
But you have to understand that science is now completely corrupted by corporate investment. So, for instance, the same corporate vested interest that stopped me or tried to stop me producing a wind turbine that actually works in an ecological fashion are the same ones that decide who gets the funding or not funding for what research projects at all the major research establishments on the planet. And if whatever it is that somebody's going to research is going to impact on their existing market or their protection of the market, they won't fund it. In the UK here, I have not had a single penny in research support for my wind turbines, for instance, or the heat exchange product, or the smart storage product that I have, or the UPS lighting systems, or the high-temperature thermoplastics, or any of it. If the list goes on and on and on. I've done this all at my own cost and with my own effort. And you hear a lot of people talking about it, you see a lot of consultants making money out of it, but you don't actually see the sort of people on the pit face benefit from it. They just have the workload, they have the problems, we cure the problems, we take on the workload. But we don't necessarily see any benefit from it personally.
It just keeps grinding on.
It does. It just wants to burn oil. It just wants to take the edge off it. It wants to provide technologies that will allow them to charge you more for burning oil. They don't want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
They don't want their markets taken away from them. They're not doing it for altruistic reasons. They're doing it because the cost of oil the extraction's going up. So you need to have it in people's minds that energy should cost more. And if it costs more to generate it with renewables, then oil looks like a cheap alternative next to it. But the only problem is that now renewable technology's overtaken, and you can generate electricity directly in your house. Half the price, you can buy it in through the wire. So the world is changing.
Yeah.
You can't uninvent things.
That's right, and you can light your home with Cree lights, as I've been doing.
Yeah.
I've been having great fun, Wynne, with using copper tape to conduct the current. So you can just kind of stick it on a piece of wood, any bit of wood, use copper tape and you can just solder the lights directly onto the copper tape.
Well, that's a great idea for low voltage lighting.
Yeah.
Because I have four wiring circuits in my house.
What's your voltage? What's your voltage levels, my friend?
Well, it's horses for courses. I'd recommend everybody to have their own mains UPS system, but also to have if they can have a backup DC storage system and lighting system, because it's low cost, it's very effective, and one of the simplest ones I fitted to my house is just a 100 watt solar panel with some lead acid storage and a 12 volt distribution wiring system to SMD three units all over the house. Mm-hmm. And you have a secondary lighting system, for pennies, that works all year round and is always there, and is good enough to light the entire house. So those things can easily be done. But for convenience, if you don't want to run extra wires around the house, then having systems that back up your existing mains or take over your mains in the event of failure, or even smart management of the mains as required, is definitely the way forward.
Excellent stuff. So, Wynn, we have a break in the middle of the thing, and I play a tune. How about the 11th Earl of Mar by Genesis?
Oh, bit of Genesis, nice.
A nice bit of Genesis, mate. So let's put that down there, and it's a long track. So we might fade it out in the middle, but I love this track. I was listening to it this morning at full blast, and I can because I'm in the middle of nowhere, and probably so can you. The 11th Earl of Mar. Yeah, the 11th Earl of Mar by Genesis, with back in the days when it was Peter Gabriel, the real Genesis. Ah, back in the day, yes. I'm on with Wynn Keach on Wolf Spirit Radio, on Tenor Sour, on Ever Beyond, on Haggy Shack, and let me just stop this, stop that. Yeah, stop flashing. Just talking to my... In the break, I was talking with Wynn, and I was saying, I worked in computers for a long, long time, and I came in from the ground floor, and in my experience, people bring dead things to me, dead computers, and it's like, and I've noticed that many people make machines go wrong. They're very tense, nervous type of people, very electrically tense, and they have a field that crackles away, and these microelectronic things, they can't handle it, and they go wrong. So some people make machines go wrong, and I was saying to Wynn that I find some people make machines go right, and I felt that the Wynn, and he immediately said, that happens to me. You make things go right, so you have an intuitive feel for how the mechanics of things work, and an imagination for being, wouldn't it? Yes. How do you get your 3D ideas, your 4D ideas down into technology? You use CAD, and are you really good, sort of smooth? Can you play a CAD computer, computer aided design for people? Can you play a CAD computer like a pianist plays a concerto?
I can. I can play CAD systems quite well. I have various of those. But the process is actually more involved than that. First of all, you have to identify the nature of the thing that's either the problem or the project that you're, the object you're trying to create. Then you have to piece together all the detail of it in your mind. And you have to identify the parts that are the bits that are either the unknown or the inadequate. And then you have to draw from whatever cross-pollinated experience you have with other engineering disciplines or science disciplines, as many of the missing parts as possible. And the bits that are left are the bits that nobody has ever experienced or understood. And that's the bit when you have to truly innovate. And that's the difficult and scary part, if you've never tried doing that. But then you really have to reach out into the possibilities of what can be creational. And you really have to effectively connect to the universe and then plug those pieces in. And when you do, then my mind just happens to work very visually, and I can model the entire object, process, project, etc. in my mind, and then I have to commit it to CAD. So I then have to wrestle the computer-aided design system to make it represent the things that I can model in my mind very quickly. I have to get the computer to be able to understand that and produce it into a 3D physical form that you can then transfer to a manufacturing machine that can make it, and then you get the pieces out of the factory and you assemble it into the thing. So it is quite an involved process, but the nugget of it that is difficult, the part that I see as being my greatest ability, is to be able to grab that inspirational step and create something that has never been created before, never thought about, never applied in that way. And that's the essence of true innovation. And that's actually more difficult than you would think.
To fill a unique gap.
Yeah, well, it's to reach out into the infinite potential of the universe and identify the parts that are appropriate to the thing you're trying to resolve. So effectively you're reaching beyond the edge of group consciousness. You're reaching to a new point of potentiality and creating a kind of new aspect of reality almost. You're taking something that's only a potential and making it something real.
Mm-hmm. Creating reality, or as we also say, manifesting reality, because you can start off with the idea of something and then you end up with the thing of something. And you have to go through, as you say, an involved process that you just described. Many layers. And most of those layers require you to, really focus on it. To be obsessive with it in some way. To encompass it. Does that influence your social life?
Yes, it's a difficult way to make a living, really. Mm. It's you take all the risk, you do all the hard work, the development, you de-risk the product, you develop it, prototype it, and in some cases manufacture, like the Ridgeblade. Mm. So you do all the work for everybody else that's in that chain. So whether it's the distributors or the resellers or the installers are all making their living off the thing you've produced. You've actually had to take all the risk and expense and difficulty and hardship at the beginning before you see a penny of it come back. Mm. So it means you go from periods of boom till bust. You go from having one successful product that makes a lot of money to a period of being in the wilderness while you produce the next one.
Capacitance.
And it's a bit like that.
Yeah, but
I mean
it's the same
if
thing.
You look back in my history, you'll see I've developed significant things. I mean, you probably know from, if you've looked into my history, that I invented the PIN processors that go on all the credit and debit cards in the world. Mm. I used to have 5 global patents on that. And I invented that as part of the awakening process with being connected to the crop circle consciousness, in that I invented it as a process to protect people from having biometric implants. And that borders 15, 20 years. And that was a very successful product, it still is, and still will continue to be, as I developed 3 generations of that. But it was such an absorbing project. I literally used to program C programming code in my sleep. I literally worked 7 days a week, I would work 14 hours a day, and when I was asleep, I would actually program in my sleep, and I would wake up and write down the code that I programmed overnight before I forgot it. That's how absorbing it can
be. Was it an algorithm, or were you writing the whole application?
In those instances, I was writing the application for a suite of products that run on various thin client environments, computer authentication environments, banking environments, the various products that we wrote. In fact, still continue to win awards globally, although I don't get the credit for it these days, but nonetheless, the things that I actually wrote, one of the most... This is how hectic my life was then, mm-hmm. There's a product called PinSafe, which has been InfoSec, which is Information Security Industry Award winner 6 years in a row, and is Lifetime Achievement Award product. It was awarded last year. I wrote that in the back of a taxi going to a meeting. You know, I literally wrote that product in the back of a taxi. So that was how hard the impact is on my personal life, in that I just didn't have one for 7 years when I was doing that. Even when I was asleep, I was still working on these things. So, yeah, it can be all-absorbing, and it can be very difficult indeed. And that's why I think very few people do what I do.
And I completely understand, you know, the idea of swapping out this very carefully constructed... It's almost like building a house of cards on several tables that are very close together, and somebody's running through the room. Oh, hello, darling. Oh, no. There goes that idea. Oh, what happened to that? Yeah. Did you get the thing there? No. Oh. More houses of cards just drop as they all fall down. Anyway, meanwhile, the life of geek. It's a strange world. All right. Let's change gears, and I'm really interested in these the wind turbine, and also, you know, how much would one of these things cost?
One for your house with a five rotor an alternator, €5,000 installed.
€5,000, and what about what? Well, if there's five rotors, so it's £1,000 a rotor, yeah, or €1,000 a rotor.
Roughly, yes. The big part of the cost is the alternator. So that's a 2 kilowatts unit that generates anything between 1,800 and 3,300 kilowatt hours a year, depending on the wind environment.
All right. Is it geared?
No, it's direct drive. No gearing at all. We don't want noise or vibration. We don't want cost. We don't want maintenance. So it's a direct drive system.
And it's friction-free in some magical way, isn't it?
No, it's not friction-free. It's obeys the laws of physics. It has bearings, it has friction.
It's not got magnetic... I thought you said it had magnetic bearings in it.
No, it doesn't. It has self-aligning bearings. Uh-huh. But no, it doesn't have magnetic bearings.
I've been waiting for this thing to come. You know, the idea of a bearing that had no contact whatsoever.
Oh, you can make those, but it's all about cost and complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I have to use a bearing that can work, you know, down to -25°C and up to +40°C, that has to rotate several million times in its life to survive the wind load forces of typhoon and hurricane force winds, and has to cost less than 10 quid if you have to change it 20 years down the line. So it's appropriate technology. That's what it's all about.
Oh, well, that's very good. I mean, you're cutting just exactly at the right point between sophistication and simplicity.
Yes, I believe in engineering elegance.
That's the word I had in my mind, is elegance.
And I also believe in appropriate technologies. Mm. So for a technology to be appropriate, it has to be in sympathy with the environment, it has to be affordable, it has to be reliable, it has to do what it says on the tin. So that's my concept, really. It has to be appropriate.
Fantastic. So where can people, and can you send these overseas? Can you send them to America, or is it more? Where do they go? Anywhere?
We're focused in northern, central, and central Europe at the moment. We have a distributor in Holland, who handles all the distribution for Europe. So that's out of my hands now. It's manufactured in Europe, it's distributed across Europe, and they tend to deal presently with sort of corporate bodies rather than individuals. I mean, I have a backlog of 5,500 people wanting to buy my wind turbines, but I don't have a distributor that's willing to sell to individuals at the moment. They will sell to companies that are willing to buy thousands or hundreds of thousands, but they presently don't sell to individuals, I'm afraid.
All right, so you need someone like B&Q. or Homebase or some company that could buy them in bulk and then distribute them to regional places like that.
Exactly.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I have moved towards that, but I say the commercial side is entirely due to the distributor. I did negotiate last year with a chain similar to B&Q that operates in Poland that were willing to sell them through their supermarket chain.
Oh, Z&Z.
I can't remember the name. Petronka, I think they were called, which means B.
Cool.
I don't think anything came of that. You have a lot of corporate conversations and you think you get somewhere and then you just wonder where it goes, really.
Yeah.
And I'm really the technical person. I just make it work. So it's for other people who have experience in these markets to make it work commercially.
That's right. You're the producer and somebody else does the marketing. I
have to know my limitations.
Yeah, exactly. and you're not interested. I see I see where you're coming from with it.
Yes, unfortunately, I've never really been interested in money. I've always done things for the right reasons and because I felt it's the right thing to do. And I've been of the opinion if you do the right things, then hopefully resource will come to you. But some years it gets real, you know, quite rough. You wonder sometimes why you're doing it, and you do wonder if there's actually anybody out there that you're doing it for. Some days.
But you've never starved of breakfast. You've never not had breakfast.
No. So. No. I'm not likely to either. You know, yeah. I'm survival trained by the Air Force. So if you might miss the odd sheep on the moors here, you know, you even know what's happening. But yeah. I've always put myself at the back of the queue. I've always had a service to others outlook. So I've never sat there and thought this will make a lot of money. I've always thought this will solve a problem. This will make people's lives better. So, you know, my target audience is my now, unfortunately, recently deceased grandmother, who, you know, between the ages of 98 and 103 when she passed away, would sit in her cottage and she was so fixated on the electric bills that she daren't turn a light on or turn the heater on or any of these things. That's my target. My target is for somebody like my gran to be able to either afford or be gifted something that can change her life so that she can turn a switch on, she can turn a plug on, she can turn a heater on, turn the television on, and no, it doesn't cost anything.
That's the thing. The heat. Right, so, you know, I have similar thought processes to you, and I decided that the key part of our civilization, the one thing that removes us from the from anyone, you know, that takes us to the next step is hot water. Because if you can have hot water, you can have central heating. If you have hot water, you can have baths and showers, and you can be clean, and you can wash your clothing. And if you have hot water, you can have, boil vegetables and make them easier to eat and more, you know, tasty, etc. You know, our entire civilization is based on the ability to heat water, and then the next stage is to heat oil, and then you can cook food. That's great.
Yes. Or you could become Icelandic and just swim, you know, in a large heated pool.
And eat raw seal meat, yes. Oh, yes, we love it. It's a delicacy in my country. Alexander Dostoevsky, you know, somebody is the daughter, yes. So, where are we?
We're talking about the appropriate technologies.
Yes, appropriate technologies. And here's another one. And I live in Scotland, right? Okay, yeah. So, yes, there's wind. Yes, there's solar.
It's one of the best wind resource in Europe.
Yeah,
not the best of solar, it must be said.
But I tell you what we got. I tell you what we got, and nobody's harvested this yet. Rain. We got bloody loads of rain, and it hammers down. Surely, when there's a piezoelectric device that takes that little hammering and turns it into a little spark, chucks it through a jewel thief. And charges a battery with it. Has nobody come up with that yet? Or am I just a genius?
You could do that. I'd be more inclined to collect the rain and then sell it to Chinese people who have no drinking water.
Ah, well, how about making something that can generate water out of polluted air?
That's possible. That technology's there already. I know several that can do it. Reverse osmosis machines and condensation machines. That's already there.
Excellent. Because, you know, when my... he's now 20. When my son was 5 years old, he took a cardboard box and stuck a couple of sticks in it, and he said, "Dad, this machine will clean the air." So, maybe...
We have machines that clean the air. They're called trees.
Trees. There you go. A couple of sticks and a cardboard box.
There you go. The cardboard's made from straw. Yeah, those are things that clean the air.
Yeah, brilliant. Bless his heart. He's making films now about whales and dolphins.
Yeah. I think the whole structure of civilization is about to go through a step change, in that we have to become more ecologically minded, otherwise we just won't be here in a couple of generations. And I think that will also cause the economy to change its dynamic, and certain parts of the economy will probably reset, and I think we're seeing a lot of that happening now.
I think the nature of the way we relate to money is definitely overdue for change, because it's a tool, it's not a master, and we're being oppressed by that. But anyway, that's another matter.
You'd miss it. Well, a lot of it doesn't exist. I mean,
none of it exists. Even the idea of gold. Yeah, gold, great. Good stuff, nice pretty metal, but actually not that rare, it seems. There's more, you know, it's just a scam. Oh, we've hidden our load away, and so we've made it rare, so we'll charge you a lot for it. Oh, that's very nice, this is a very nice pretty metal. Yeah. you know what I'm saying?
Money largely is notional value now, it's an electronic virtual value of something that was once real.
Exactly.
And that's the problem. And you know, it can be here and gone in an instant. You know, it's just to hit the return button on a computer and it's gone one morning. You know, that's where we are. And then what are you left with? 5% of the actual asset value of what you thought you had in the bank.
All just as numbers. You know, somebody's turned your assets into numbers. we've all been digitized.
Well, the problem is that money largely isn't real, but debt is. That's the problem.
Yeah, because that's what money... We trade in debt rather than we trade in money.
We trade in debt, and debt is an obligation. That obligation's real.
Yeah.
Whereas money is just... It's just the oil in the engine. It's just the bit that makes it go round.
So, shall we talk about what your... What are you putting in that is completely innovative? What are you placing into the time stream here? You know, what are you coming out with next? Because this
I'm doing two things. First thing is I'm obviously putting in little bits of simple technology. You know, my smart storage system, which not only can use renewables, but buy and sell energy, and be networked to do this on a large scale. All of course, you know, very cost efficient. Renewable technologies, eco living technologies, ability to grow food faster and more reliably with less contaminants. But also to bring all the nuggets of the technology I've been developing together into systems that allow people to live in ways they thought they couldn't. So for instance, my objective with the three technologies I've spoken to today, the heat exchange system, the wind turbine system, and the storage system, enable me to be able to construct, by my own design, I have on the drawing board, houses that are affordable, that are high quality, I mean very high quality compared to most houses that are around now, eco-friendly, but can be completely funded by the energy savings and energy sales and exports of the systems that are integrated into the building. So that, for instance, you know, I'm looking at a house where you wouldn't have to have a mortgage. You could simply buy it on the same finance package you bought your car with, and within 10 years, your house had paid for itself. That's a kind of way of life that nobody thinks could be appropriate. They wouldn't think that, that most people today, they can barely afford to rent a property in England, or never mind buy one.
Totally.
But but they don't realise that with simple technology and the correct application of it, it's possible to change the dynamic of certain aspects of civilization so that you can have a more fulfilling life where the actual demands on you to support that system are lower. So not only do you have a lower impact upon the ecology of the planet and actually contribute by actually providing support for the rest of the society around you in terms of certainly energy infrastructure, but that you are able to have a higher quality of life for less actual drudgery and difficulty, and be able, for instance, another thing I'm keen to do is to be able to provide affordable retirement homes for people with the same technology, in that grouping around 6 of these houses together in a small hamlet, it would be possible to sell 5 houses for people who want to downsize from their existing typical UK house to a retirement bungalow, but that the bungalow can provide enough energy sales to pay for the 6th house where you have a permanent carer residing, and it can earn enough money to actually pay for a carer to look after the 5 houses. That sort of thing would make a much more distributed, resilient micro society for people who wanted to opt into it, in ways that you get off the rat run of, I work all my life, I raise a family, have a large house, then you suddenly become ill or you start to suffer dementia, and so you're put in a care home and they sell your house, take everything away from you to pay for your care, and so you die and then away you go again. So I think the way I can see a path through to expanding possibilities of social evolution, I think, is as important as the technology.
Excellent vision. Strangely enough, I also share some of that. You know, the idea of these little, you could apply the micro village thing, talking there, micro hamlet, what do you call it, of a cluster of houses. I was thinking you could do this, you could have a healing center that had people who would stay for a week or a weekend with a group of healers. And whatever they need to be worked on, whether it's like they need their chiropractic or they need their Reiki or they need their spiritual meditation, or you know, whatever they need, acoustic healing, that each of the different houses contained perhaps a couple or various people who would address those issues that person had, so they would have a complete like workover all at the same time.
It's a very similar idea. I'm looking at basically taking the infrastructure that you need to have a modern civilized life and getting the infrastructure to do the work, in the same way that the roof of the house does the work for my wind turbine. In this environment, the house can actually do the financial work to support you, rather than you working to 25 years of your life to pay a mortgage to buy the house. The house pays for itself and helps support you, as well as helps support the planet. And also, for instance, if you're to make affordable housing available to homeless people, some of those homeless people, you know, may or may not be able to contribute anything. They may be vulnerable and damaged people who may not be able to contribute very much, but just by living their life where they live in that infrastructure, that house can actually earn an income. It can actually support national electricity grid. It can provide grid buffering for renewables. It can actually do the work for you in the background, even if you aren't physically or even mentally able to contribute the level society would expect you to do to be able to have that quality of life.
And, you know, this is the society that we're looking at in the future is one that isn't slaving like a slave to pay rent on a planet that you were born on. You know, I think that's one of those turning point conversation pieces. So we turn everything around when we, as you say, you make the house do the work rather than do the work for the house. How about, yeah, hey, let's make, How about things like self-cleaning toilets and stuff that cleans itself, or stuff that doesn't get dirty, or stuff that really sticky stuff when it's really hot doesn't stick and burn like everything else does. You know, have you worked on like worktop materials and you know, what about a floor that doesn't break glass but is firm?
Yeah. All those things can be done, but they're lower my list of priorities. I'm more about keeping old people warm and safe, getting homeless people off the streets, getting people who are working in lower income brackets but doing very valuable jobs who can't afford their own houses to be able to have their own place to live and bring families up. That's what I'm focused on.
Well, that's really a major priority, especially how these modular houses, by the way, have you, how far down the road have you got? Have you got to like a prototype made, or is it just a maquette?
So I have all the equipment designed, I have the houses designed, I've manufacturers identified and negotiated with. I'm ready to go on those things. I just need to earn some income from the other products to be able to fund it, or find some other way of funding it.
Have you tried crowdfunding?
I thought of crowdfunding. It's not something I have experience of, but I can see the advantage of it in that it enables you through communication to identify people who are interested in the very things that you're producing. So
exactly,
you're harnessing the power of those people to bring the product to life. So I can see a huge synergy with that. It's just something I've never tried. I'm tempted to try the heat exchange products because that's something that's simple for people to understand and be able to buy off the shelf and apply to their own existing systems. So I'm certainly considering it. I don't know how effective these things are, but
I tell you what's effective. Video.
Yeah,
you get a video made of it, and then people will say, oh, that's a really good idea, where can I get one? Oh, you can get one here you go.
Yes, it's the thing I see with crowdsourcing is it enables you to get through that first step. I mean, the problem I have with any manufacturer has is that to get the economy of scale, you have to have batch sizes that are significant, which means you have to have a lot of money invested in getting the first batches produced. So if, for instance, you have 1,000 people who want to, through the crowdsourcing thing, benefit from getting, say, the heat grabber system at a lower price because they've contributed to the crowdfunding, then you've automatically got a batch size that brings the cost of the unit down at the first pass, rather than coming to a market with more expensive products at a lower batch numbers and then building up the manufacturing over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
At which point you're vulnerable, because that's when other companies will look at it and think, there's a market there, I'll go and steal this, and not necessarily make a product of the same quality or resilience or safety or reliability. That's when the possibility of harm being done to the value of the product.
Mm. So really, you've got a distribution and marketing gap there. That's all I can see.
Which is why with Richblade I've taken on a distributor who now has responsibility for that, and so I have to hand over and say, okay, you're the expert in that field. You do that. Mm-hmm. I've done my part. Now you do the part that you're expert at.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but I would also suggest, you know, getting somebody make a video. And that would take a whole, that would bring you a whole different market.
Well, there are videos of Richblade out there. You just have to look on YouTube and the like. And there's quite a lot of video out there. It's people actually that I can understand what you say about video. The thing with Richblade is people never really get it until they see one.
Mm.
And when they see one and they can't hear it and they see it's operating, they suddenly go, ah.
Uh-huh.
Whereas you could describe it thousands of words, pictures, images, people wouldn't get it. People that actually see them in the flesh, they just go, ah, now I understand.
Here's the thing, Wyn.
Okay.
You were saying that it doesn't harm a creature, because if it gets caught in it won't get caught in the blades, because the blades have a repulsive force around them that keeps them.
Well, no, they're designed to rotate away from anything going into the unit. So, any part of the unit that isn't shrouded by protective aerofoil sections of the casing are always rotating away from you. So if you're a bird flying, say, 40 miles an hour, and you fly into the wind turbine and the wind speed is, say, 10 miles an hour, then you actually hit it. You actually hit the turbine 10 miles an hour slower than if you flew into the casing. And it's also designed so that there's no sharp edges are presented to any rotating component that's exposed. So if you reach into the rotor, which I've done on many occasions when it's operating, your hand will hit the top of a blade that is moving up and away from you. So it will throw your hand back out of the unit, but you won't hit a sharp edge. There's nothing to trap or drag you into it. It will simply gently throw you back out again. And if you're a bird intent on flying into it, you'll just simply be carried through at a lower speed than you flew into it, and then thrown out the rear end as it's designed to.
Okay, so here's the thing. Have you thrown paper darts through it?
I've put everything from smoke to simulated butterflies through it.
Simulated butterflies?
Yeah,
what,
yeah.
What did you make from? Honestly, plants.
I used polystyrene for those. Right. We had to do a butterfly impact test for the National Park to get it approved for planning here. So, yeah, we tested it for large insects and butterflies. I've tested it for absolutely everything.
Even your dragonfly is safe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I've had, 5 years of real-world testing of the units, both on mainland Europe and in the UK. We've never had a bird strike in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Not one. No bird injury, death or anything. They love to sit on top of them. We've never had any animal injury in 5 years, and I can't think of a wind turbine in the world that can claim that.
Well, that is a very good, good.
And we've also had them. The units survive real world wind gusts of 106 miles an hour, we bench tested them to 120 miles an hour wind, but we've actually seen real 106 mile an hour winds through them. To the point where the anemometer that was attached to the building was torn to pieces, but the ridge blade still worked perfectly.
So, and this is one of the things about the ridge blade. Its operating parameters are way beyond. I mean, as I said, you know, the great big turbines, they take a bit of a gust to get it going. This turbine will go in a very light breeze, 2 or 3 miles an hour, if I remember correctly.
They self-start in 1.2 mile an hour winds, and they'll operate up to 120 mile an hour winds, and completely operate perfectly at 120 mile an hour winds.
So, what's the difference in voltage generation between a very light breeze and?
Oh, the voltage range on wind is much larger than for photovoltaic.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, in a the normal operating range, although it will self-start at 1.2 miles an hour, it's effectively idling until you have a 4 mile an hour wind. Then it will start to produce electricity. That's on a grid tie inverter. If it was on a battery system, it would generate as soon as it turns, but the grid tie inverters have a minimum voltage threshold before they'll cut in, which is usually around 60 volts. So, the voltage range it operates over is anything between 60 volts and 400 volts over the normal wind speed operating range.
Right. So when you're generating the power that's going back into the grid, how do they know? how can they tell that you're sticking electricity into the grid? And the other question, I know this is really techie and geeky, sorry about this, everybody, but this is the questions that come up in my head when I talk about it. When you're putting the energy back into the grid, do you have to put it in at the same phase? Like when the voltage is at zero and it goes up, do you have to put it in exactly matching that? Or
do you
have
yes.
to put it in at a different phase so that they know this is stuff that's coming back?
No, it has to be in phase with the connection, whether that be single phase or three phase. All the phases have to be synchronized, which the grid tie inverters do. What a grid tie inverter does is it actually times its addition of a slightly higher voltage to the mains voltage that it detects. Right. So it waits for each cycle, it charges up, ready to supply the little AC voltage, and when the grid voltage crosses zero, it then applies a volt or 2 volts or 3 volts above the voltage it's measuring from the grid. That's how grid tie works. But yes, the grid tie inverters we use are quite sophisticated. They have their own internal metering, so they monitor how much electricity comes in from the wind turbine, and they monitor how much it exports back to the grid. And also in a lot of countries, you also have to have a secondary export meter as well, which is a separate meter that goes on the output from the inverter and measures how much is being squirted into the mains, as it were.
Mm. So, I mean, those things are they standard units, or did you build a more sophisticated?
No, those are standard units. So those are those have been widely developed for the photovoltaic market. So we just use a wind adapted version of the units for the photovoltaic market. So that's the important thing, is that those are mass manufactured, they're known reliability, and they also have the correct certification for the countries we want to put the units into.
Yeah. And you buy them locally. They're locally supplied rather than being schlepped.
They come with the system. So, mm-hmm. For instance, our distributor also distributes the same inverters. And so, you buy a wrist blade, you get the inverter straight from the distributor. You get the full system. It just, you know, you drop it on your roof, you run the wire, and you plug it in the mains, and away it goes.
Fantastic. How does it cling to the roof? Do you have to put bolts through the thing, or does it kind of just sit there?
It uses the same mounting hardware that photovoltaic systems use to mount to the roofs.
Oh.
So we use the existing certified roof spar connections, which then come up onto the tiles, and then there is a mounting rail, which is the same rail that is used for mounting photovoltaic cells onto roofs. The wrist blade is designed to then bolt directly to those rails.
Oh.
So this means that the same installer that installs PV cells on your roof is the same man who can fit ridge blade. It's the same skill set and the same materials.
Perfect. Very neat. Very neat.
So elegance and appropriate engineering is what I try to do.
So look, if anybody out there is listening to this and thinks that they can find a way for wind to get large orders, that's what you need, is a large order, regular bulk large orders, so that you can get a good manufacturing margin that can then supply systems to poor people all over the world, people in cold countries like Hungary and Poland and war-torn places, and like be able to deploy. I mean, Did they fit into a nice neat box as well?
But funnily enough, they come in a very neat box. Yes,
I bet they do. As nice as Apple? Are they?
Not quite as nice as Apple. But my boxes can be reused 20 times.
20 times. What?
So that they don't upset the ecology of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, the thing is, we're pretty much sewn up for Central Europe. So anything from Holland right across to Poland, the Czech Republic, we have distribution. But there are other areas of the world that my European distributor doesn't deal with and has no intention of. Mm. And so there are places, if you lived in Australia, Japan, Caribbean, South America, Canada, North America, any of those places, those areas are all available for somebody to take a distribution license or a manufacturing license to make them. And we'd certainly look at that, because it's not my job to manufacture millions of these units. It's my job to make the unit work as well as it can at the best price, the best reliability, and to identify manufacturers that can make it. And if we've done that for the Europe, and we're starting to roll them out now, but there is the rest of the world for people who want them. If you live in an area that's got a good wind resource, for instance, Australia has got a fantastic wind resource, but if you lived in India, you wouldn't want one because you've got plenty of sunshine but no wind. So, you know, the world is a big and complex place, but there are huge markets out there that I certainly have no ability to access that would be an opportunity for somebody else, and I'd love to hear from people who would be interested in that if they were credible.
Excellent, excellent. So, we're coming to the end of the show. When you've got so much, you've probably got loads of websites. Is there a kind of general WinKeach portal?
No, there isn't. Because these things are not about me. You know, the product is about the product. It's not about me. It's like my research into, you know, the more esoteric phenomena. It's not about me. It's about the product or the material. So, yeah, Richblade has its own website. So we have richblade.com. We have richblade.co.uk. And that will show you the ins and outs of Richblade.
Let me just spell that. That's R-I-D-G.
No. Yes, Ridge as in roof ridge, R-I-D-G-E.
Yeah, Blade as in...
All one word, Blade, B-L-A-D-E. It's a series of wingception blades that sit on a roof ridge, so we call it Richblade.
Exactly.
It does what it says on the tin. Or as Bernie, my colleague, says... with his view to the Irish players, you know, if they're spinning, we're winning. So, that's Rich Blade. And if anybody's in Europe and is interested in a number of them, then the distributor is Libra Energy in North Holland. So they're very well known in Holland, Benelux, right across to Germany. Their website will contain also more details on Rich Blade.
Awesome, awesome. Now, I mean, the other thing about Richblade is that we haven't spoken about, excuse me, is that the wings, no, sorry, the turbine is not just what I call a squirrel cage is that you get in an electric heater, mm-hmm. which is a little cylinder that has just flat blades on it. Yours is slightly more sophisticated than this.
These are aircraft wing sections, and it's a wing section I specifically designed, as used to be my old job, for specifically high torque generation and low wind speed blade lift activation. So it's a blade that's it's a modified wing section specifically designed to produce as much torque and power as possible from a cross-flow wind turbine.
So basically, you got a whole bunch of airplane wings stuck on a spindle.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, it's not greatly different from the wing section you'd find on a Cessna aircraft. But if you've made a large one of my wing sections and put it in a Cessna, I'd defy you to try and fly it because it would try to do backward somersaults every time you went forward.
Too much lift.
Yeah. Too much lift, and the centre of gravity is designed to maximise the torque rather than maximise stability.
Mm-hmm. So it would pull wheelies.
It would pull wheelies. It would definitely pull wheelies. Yes, but it's a proper wing section that is extruded. So you get the performance of a wing section, but from a flat extrusion, which is a much less expensive manufacturing technique than having to have curved blade sections. It also means that the relative speed of the inner and outer sides of the blade are comparatively close. So you don't, for instance, like on a large, what you call a HORT, horizontal axis wind turbine, or propeller type, you have the tip of the propeller can be basically approaching the speed of sound and creating noise, whereas the centre can be going around very gently. And you don't have that difference in wingtip to rotation speed ratio, so it's absolutely of no mystery to me as to why it makes no aerodynamic noise. It's designed not to.
Well, because noise is a wastage. Noise is a friction.
It's a pollution.
Yeah, it's a distortion of the pure energy transfer. I'm really glad to see that. So you're just basically using a regular dynamo, what's the other thing? Alternator.
Alternator, yes.
Yeah. From a truck or something like that?
Oh, no, it's more sophisticated than that. We use permanent magnet three-phase alternators, or PMGs, permanent magnet generators. Mm-hmm. These are units that don't require an external excitation field, and are compact and high powered.
Right. So that's more or less a dynamo, isn't it?
It is basically a big three-phase dynamo.
Yes, yeah, nice.
The sort of thing you used to get in the centre of bicycles to run your run your lighting on them when I was a boy.
Yeah, back when things were built to last and not fall apart.
Yeah, except these only have to rotate a couple of hundred RPM to produce the maximum power. They don't have to rotate at very high speed.
Mm. Here's the thing. Talking of inventions, right? Here's an invention that I just... Well, not really an invention, just a service. Is that... all of the things that break down in the world are deliberately made to break down due to built-in obsolescence. You know,
yep.
Deliberately. Wouldn't it be nice if we were to be able to find all the part numbers and part designs of all the pieces that were designed to break down and make them in much more durable materials that could be 3D printed and sold throughout the world?
Or just appropriately manufactured. That's kind of what I was trying to do with this unit. My unit's designed to survive everything that nature can throw at it for 20 years. And at the
and
end
then
of
what
life,
happens? Then what happens?
At the end of life, it's 100% recyclable. Mm-hmm. All the aluminium, every piece of stainless steel can be taken and reused, can be melted down and made into something else.
Mm-hmm. And the permanent magnets, is it a moving magnet or a moving core?
What do you call a pancake alternator? So you have effectively like a drum brake hub from a car,
mm-hmm.
and if you can imagine where normally the brake lining would contact the inside of the hub, you have sections of rectangular magnets. And then in the centre you have the three coils for the three phases.
Right.
That's kind of how they work.
Nice.
So you connect the outside of what would have been a drum brake to the drive line from the units, and whenever that rotates it generates electricity just like a dynamo.
Right. And so you've got this variable thing, and then it goes into your alternator, and it's going to be coming out at 240 volts, a variable amperage.
Yeah, what happens is the voltage from the output from the generator can vary between 60 and 400 volts. Mm. It then travels down the three phases, which is a very effective way of transmitting the power to a three-phase rectifier.
Mm-hmm.
So it then comes out as DC voltage between 60 and 400 volts,
right.
Which then go into the grid cell inverter, which is designed to accept that range of voltage and produce 220 volts straight outside.
Nice. And what's the how much current can you draw off that? I mean, how many kilowatts?
It depends on the unit. The domestic ones are designed to be 2 kilowatt output, and the industrial ones are designed to be 4 kilowatt output.
All right.
And that's 4 kilowatts is the maximum you can feed into the grid without getting permission from the grid operator. So that's as much as you can squirt down one line without getting planning from the planning application from the local network operator.
So in the coming future of these super hurricane storms,
mm-hmm.
It might behoove us to to get some of these, because it might be the only thing that's left.
Yeah, so also EMP proof. So if you get a coronal mass ejection, your solar panels may fry, but this boat will just keep ticking.
Brilliant.
So yeah, but it's only a windmill. You know, it's the first of many products, and I'm some way beyond that now. But it's all part of it's part of the puzzle. It's an answer to one of the parts of the puzzle as to how can we get off this addiction to crude oil.
Exactly.
And how can we live a technological, civilized life on this planet without damaging the planet.
Yep, absolutely. In my opinion, whenever whenever there's an explosion of oil or petrol, the planet feels it.
Well, in some ways, it's the lifeblood of the planet was sucking out and burning.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, and I'm really more than anything just looking for people around the planet who have the same vision, who want to do these things. A lot of people talk about it, a lot of people moan about it, but as you say, it's probably only 6% of the population that actually will do something about it.
Yeah, so that's fine.
And I'm doing my bit, I'm providing the tools, and now it's a case of just seeing who takes them up.
Yeah, well, look, let's see if I can help you expose that. I am very happy to have you on the show. If you would like to talk about your adventures and experience, you know, what we talked about tonight is a very small subset of the actual Winkeach. I just wanted to introduce you, really.
And this is the boring stuff.
No, it's not boring. Some people find this interesting. A lot of people like to know where things come from and understand
It's fair to say I've pushed the limits of understanding of reality in the last 30 years of my life. And certainly I have first-hand experience of a lot of things that provide me the answers to a lot of the questions people ask. It's been an unusual ride.
Indeed it has. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Winkeach. Again, quickly, your website?
www.ridgeblade.com.
Ridgeblade.com. Thank you very much, Winkeach. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, JP.
Beyond.